Right.
Yes.
That's right.
And all of, and so, you know, it was either came out of a sub or came out of a trawler when we had our agents or our commandos or that sort of thing. That was the first thing they made a beeline for, was books and for these machines, you see. So we, all those were pitched. And, but you know, all the time that we worked, I made some very, very good friends, and they were really the tops of people to work with. But our greatest, what we really wanted more than anything, we just thought, wouldn't it be absolute heaven to have a job whereby we just went to work every day at 9 o'clock and we quit at 6?
That would be it.
That would be heaven. Yes, Dan. Would you like to have a cup of tea? I think. That I was awfully sorry for so many of those young men that were working at Bletchley. My whole section that I was in were all civilian. There was no one had any protection of a uniform. Because they were very well educated boys, all come from the universities. They had, you know, they came from very good homes. And they couldn't tell their parents what they were doing. And I'm sure that they must have had very embarrassing times, especially for a man, because they were young, you must remember. They were all between 20 and 30, without a uniform, and all they could say, "Oh well, I'm working in the civil service capacity." Well, you could imagine how some people, the little bit of sneer, "Oh, isn't that nice for you," when their son had been in a bomber or been killed or something.
Like a recognition, I imagine that would be, and it reverberated completely after the war too, when it came to job opportunity and hiring.
Oh, these people were all pretty well.
They were all okay.
They were all okay, and they were all found. They were found and rewarded well, as far as giving them good positions.
Things like that.
Yes, I'm sure they were. They don't have to be.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them went back to university. A lot of them went in for teaching, I suppose, and a lot of them, of course, still kept on.
Working in a civil service capacity,
yeah. With much better pay, and a lot of them perhaps be sent abroad to other places. I mean, this didn't all end, you know, with the war. Then you had the Japanese war went on.
Yeah.
But I didn't know it had anything to do with that.
What's my
name?
What, dear?
I'm
all right, sweetie. I'll just put it in. No, don't bother about me.
You mentioned as an aside before that your father felt a great indebtedness to Canada, and I think it's an affinity for Canada, and it, beginning of the war, he went down to Canada House and arranged something. I think it's the most interesting.
That's right. Well, he owed, he felt in his mind, in his conscience, that he, not only was being very fond of Canada, but he felt that he had returned his health to him, and he felt very indebted and very close to Canadians. He loved it, house in Canada. He really did. He loved the farm, the life, and the people of it. So when the war broke out, because of being his past injuries and of course age and that sort of thing, there was very little that he could do. He did take a stint at being a special constable. He was supposed to go around and see if there's any bombs dropped or anything like that. Well, this was north of London, as I said before, and we didn't have anything too much going. I mean, you could spend days and days and days doing this sort of thing, not see anything very much. We had a few, but nothing very much. And so then he went to Canada House, and he thought of all these Canadians coming over. And I think partially because of his own pleasure, too, and he wanted to see Canadians again. He offered our home as a hospitality center for any serving Canadian. When they had, say, a 48-hour leave or possibly longer, and that they would have a place that they could go.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew their own country could, was interested in them as Canadians, I think. All with what was expected of them is if they would bring their, remember to bring their traveling coupons, because food was really very rough, and you couldn't have afforded it.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't have done it. It wasn't a case of the money.
Money.
It was the case of being able to have those coupons to be able to feed them when they came. And I had a younger sister and brother, you see, and they were both up in boarding school, so we had two bedrooms, free, theirs. And so that was easily picked up, and it wasn't long before we, you know, we did have some Canadians came and stayed. We had some from Quebec. We had them from, one was a French Canadian. And we had two or three from Toronto. We had from Vancouver and Victoria. And the thing was that once they came down, I, you know, they would come again. We didn't have such a turnover that we expected, because they all had such a great time.
You had a big billiard room or something.
Yes, we had a billiard room and a library and a little tiny room downstairs which had a pinball machine. I don't know where that actually came. That came with the house. And we had five bicycles. And we had dinner every night at 7. And then by around about 8:30, my mother and father and whoever the Canadians were, would climb up on these bicycles and away we'd go to the local pub. And by the time we got there, it was 8:30 or 9, well, the pubs closed at 10,
yeah.
But it was enough to have a game of darts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a joke with the locals. And these young fellows really did, they really enjoyed themselves as much as they could. And they,
when you weren't working at Bletchley Park, you were obtaining Canadian...
Well, in a way, I was always, you know, used to think, oh, I hope to goodness they come when I'm on the right shift, you see, because if I was on the 4 to 12 shift, well, again, I was picked up
mm-hmm.
at 10 past 3 and I didn't get back until 1:45. So I missed all that,
mm-hmm.
you know, or missed much of it. And I mean, you know, and night shift too, of course, I couldn't go out at, but I was on the night shift when I was going to be picked up around about 11. I was, you know, retired and, you didn't go out having a drink at all before you went to work.
No, if you got those many hours to put in.
Not those hours, and you had to, you couldn't, you mustn't make a mistake on those things, because it was very easy to make a mistake.
Very exacting word.
Yeah.
You saying something about cocoa or Nestle's Quick?
Oh, yes. That was really rather a fun thing. So many of these Canadian boys used to, you know, they would say to my dad, who was always called Cap, they'd say, oh, Cap, look, is there anything we can get our family to send you, you know? And they really appreciated, you know, I think, a place to stay, a place that was home. And you know, we said, oh, well, that was very, very nice. But they always did. They often wrote back. We had some wonderful parcels that were sent from Canadians, parents in Canada. And then they would ask sometimes, well, you know, what would you like, you know, my mom to send? And I would say, oh, if we could possibly have some of that. It was a hot chocolate drink, and I think it was put out by Nestle now. I'm not too sure about that. But it was sort of the equivalent we have today. You know, all you had to do was boil water. And pour it in, you know, a jug, and you had, it was already sweetened, it had the chocolate in it and the powdered milk and the whole bit, you see, so, because those things we didn't have. Because those were an absolute boon to us on night shift.
Mm.
Because I would take this tin in, and when it got around to being around about 3 o'clock in the morning, and you were cold, and you were tired, we happened to have a little hot plate in the thing. We had somebody had a kettle. Some of the other shifts, I suppose, were drinking awful Bovril or something, which they used to have, or heat up something. But I used to make this, was known as Nanny's Brew. And when we had slack times on night shift, we used to invite, say, some of the heads of our different section. There was Professor Turing, and there was Alexander, and there was Patrick Mann, and a whole lot of names that wouldn't really mean anything to you, but these, they were all very clever people. And they would come in, and we'd give them a drink of this hot brew, you see. And while they were there, this was when we would have slack times, and oftentimes at night times, we'd go an hour, maybe even a whole hour, nothing to do, and we all sat around and talked. And they would, so often start, they would have a debate amongst themselves. Our conversation revolved over politics a great deal. And it got to the evolution of man. We went through religion. And, every subject that you could imagine. I mean, science, all sorts of things were discussed in this room. And, you know, through those sort of Nanny's Brew, I sort of realized myself, you know, I'm getting quite an education here.
Oh, the university education.
You know, one of the, and we learned the backgrounds of some of these men that worked there. One name, he was a German Jew by the name of Rolf Nosquith. Rolf was one of the nicest little men I think I've ever known. He was only about 23 or 24. And his father was Russian, his mother was Polish. And his father had left Russia after revolution time because they were manufacturing. And he'd gone to Poland and then he'd met Rolf's mother and then they ended up by being in Germany, I understand, with other members of their family, and they started a factory in Germany. And there they remained and did very well until 1933. And the writing was on the wall. And Rolf told me himself, a very shy little man, but eventually after years of, you know, quiet talk, you get their confidence. And he told me, he said he remembered when he was only about 14, I guess. I guess he would be about 14 or 15, 33. He must only be about 21 or 22. At any rate, them all discussing it in Germany and saying that we have to leave. And one brother chose to come out to the United States and the other one came to England. And he started up another factory up in the Birmingham area. And Rolf had never been to school. He had poor health. And he was very, very clever and had tutorship all his life until he went to Cambridge University. He spoke German fluently, of course. He did have knowledge of Russian. And he spoke French and English. I said to him, which was rather, one time, I said, Rolf, your name Nosquith, now that's not a your father Russian, that's not a Russian name, which was named Nosquith. Oh, and he laughed. He said, no, it isn't Nosquith. It was some, and I believe he said it was some name, something like Noskowitz or something like that. But when they came to England, they decided that this word name was bad, trying business and that sort of thing, and they would change their name. So they chose one of the oldest family's names, English name in history, which was Asquith. So they put the Nuss of their name onto the Quith of Asquith and called themselves Nosquith. A lovely story, I think that was. He was a very, very nice little man, and he worked very, very hard, and he suffered from tummy problems and that sort of thing, but I've never known him miss a day or miss a time. Sometimes the head of the shift did have to tell him to stay home for 3 or 4 days and said, if you come to work, Rolf, we're going to send you back again because he was not well enough to do the work. And he was frightened for his own health. There was a girl, too, by the name of Joan Clark. Brilliant little woman she was. Unbelievable. Very, very odd, though. Terribly odd. She always talked in a great way. I've got this for you to do, Annie. Oh, yes, yes, isn't this fun? And then she'd sit down and tell me and show me what. It would go into too much detail, and I couldn't do it anyway. Detail what we had to do. But, you know, with so many of them, it was very hard, really, to talk about generalities. I mean, I would say, oh, gosh, look at that rain out there. Joan, just look at that. Isn't that awful? And she'd look out the window in a glazed sort of look and say, rain. Oh, yes, rain. Rain. And hop off, you know, and sometimes skip along the corridor.
Not a clue of a
book.
Not
a clue. There was another man there, wasn't in our section, but he was a chess champion of Scotland, and he used to often play chess, have a table set up with my head of Alexander. His chess game used to go on for days, you know. And he always wore a hat. I've never seen him without a hat. He wore the hat in his office. He wore a long scarf often, quite in the middle of the heat of summer, but he didn't know that it was summer. Round his neck. There is a story which I think is just too far-fetched to tell, because there were a lot of chess experts there. But there is a story, whether it is true or not, I don't know. But there was one professor who was reputed to have broken a small bone in his leg by playing chess. Because there were heavy, big, heavy chairs that were in the library of Bletchley Park. And he wound his leg around the chair so much and concentrating so hard that he broke, snapped a bone in his leg.
And this was their relaxation from
that was
the
relaxation. They did the Times crossword puzzle in their lunch hour.
Yeah.
I could do the Times crossword puzzle. I'd be at it for hours and hours and hours, and I'd think very lucky if I managed to fill three clues in. And they did it on, well, not their lunch hour, actually, because nobody had a lunch hour. A three-quarters of an hour ticket to lunch and eat and do this. And they were all very excited. And, oh, I know, I've got it.
It's another bunch of kids.
Yeah. But, you see, the thing was that they loved their work because it was a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
There was two incentives here for people such as a lot of these characters in Fletcher Park, where they were motivated by two things. Patriotism, yes. And also, we've got to solve the puzzle. And their work was, I mean, their joy as well. They lived for it. They were fanatics.
Well, I just can't imagine what you did with them at the end of the, you know, busting loose with all these people in 45. I mean, some stayed on.
I know.
But what did they do?
I don't know. Well, there'll be other puzzles.
There'll be other puzzles, sure.
Perhaps even a bit bigger. Bigger now, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Thank you very much for making time for me.
Not at all.
Thank you.
I hope I've been of some help anyway.
I think so.